Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today, I am joined by two guests. Associate Professor Rhiannon Evans from Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University, and Professor Kaelin Davenport, Head of the Centre for Classical Studies at the Australian National University. This is episode CCL, Anthology of Interest, IV, in which we, the triumvirate of interesting people, will talk about three topics for 3 minutes. There we go. That is an in situ intro recording. Are we all ready? We're familiar with the format. It's been a while.
Yep, ready to go.
Okay, who wants to go first? Who has something interesting to open us with?
My first topic I've entitled A Phoenix in the Forum, mostly for the alliteration. Now, you might think you know something about the phoenix, and maybe if you know something, associate this mythical bird, I'm sorry, they don't exist, with Egypt. It's very much associated with the sun. I think my first experience of it was reading The Phoenix and the Carpet as a child, with a very long life and with rebirth. So the whole idea that the phoenix burns itself up and then a new one is born from the ashes, an egg appears, something like that. That might be your association that you already have with the phoenix. And the implication from this is that there is only one. So if we go back, way back, Herodotus says it appears every 500 years. This then gets a bit murky and the time gets expanded. So in Tacitus, it's seen in Egypt, but he says that it should come every 500 years or maybe every 1,461 years. So because Tacitus says that it was seen in 34 CE, he also says it hasn't been long enough. That's only been 250 years. So as you can see, it was pretty jumbled even in antiquity, the folklore around the phoenix. Tacitus says this was probably a false phoenix, so a kind of fake news phoenix. And if I just go a little bit into the context there, either side of this are lists of Tiberius's victims in Tacitus's annals. This is book 6, chapter 28. So this is an unlikely context, at least for Rome, for this miraculous epiphany. But what I'm really interested in, will surprise nobody, is from Pliny's Natural History. Pliny puts it as the second bird in his bird book, which is book 10 of the Natural History. He puts it in Arabia, so as far away as he possibly can, I think, a bit more distant now, maybe because Arabia is associated with spices. He tells us that the bird's nest is made of cinnamon and frankincense. There's no fire that burns up the phoenix, but it dies in its nest, and a maggot emerges, grows into a chick, which takes its nest to the City of the Sun, as he calls it, near the mythical island of Pankaya, for its predecessor's funeral rites. He describes it as eagle-sized, purple, with a golden neck and blue and a rose-coloured tail. So pretty garish, even by Roman standards. Pliny has a slightly later date, 47 CE, so there's phoenixes all over the place now, for its most recent appearance. And he says that it was brought to Rome 800 years after the foundation of the city, so a big date. That's all he tells us, though. Who brought it? Pliny doesn't tell us. He does say that it was displayed in the Comitium, kind of gets involved in Roman politics, and that this is backed up by the official records, by the Acta. But, here's the kicker, even gullible old Pliny doesn't buy it. Even though it's in the records, nobody would doubt that this phoenix was fake. It was falsum. No, he doesn't say the phoenix doesn't exist, but it's this one that's not real. So he believes in phoenixes, or a phoenix, but this one's not the phoenix. Was it perhaps a cosmetically enhanced eagle? Again, Pliny doesn't say. Who was peddling these false phoenixes? Were they making money out of it? Pliny doesn't tell us, but I think we could construct a narrative around it, and if we ever do some kind of drama of Rome that includes 47 CE, I'd like to see the phoenix there in all of its glory.
It sounds like a P.T. Barnum of some sort. How very strange. Did you know that Phoenix in the Forum was on my long list?
Okay, our minds are converging. That's a worry.
I was wondering, you know, which animal was dressed up to be the phoenix. I think an eagle's a good idea.
Well, yeah, I mean, he says it's eagle-sized, whatever that means, because there are various types. But it would seem like a bit of a kick in the face to Rome, because the eagle is, you know,
of course,
the bird of Jupiter, and therefore you shouldn't really be messing with it. And also, I wouldn't mess with an eagle anyway. Maybe a trained bird handler could do it.
He doesn't say that the phoenix has anything to do with fire, though, does he?
He doesn't, no. He doesn't include that.
That's interesting. So that must be a later thing or a more of a mythology
kind of
entry?
That does seem to come later and comes out of, well, I guess Christian period texts.
Yeah.
I think that they like this idea of the cleansing and rebirth, perhaps. Yeah. Or it may even, and I don't know enough about this, may be connected to which particular funeral rites are in vogue at which particular time.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't appear here. I think there's enough going on even for Pliny to not need that.
Okay, because he does talk about volcanic eruptions and he talks about Etna and Vesuvius and he talks about life coming from the ashes and the rebirth. So he's familiar with the concept of that. But even this, it said it was something like maggots coming out of the...
It's horrible, isn't it? The maggot. So maggot or worm.
It's a lot yucky. More kind of...
rather than an egg. An egg seems cleaner.
It's a lot less mythological than I would have kind of assumed.
Yeah, a bit more earthy.
Yeah. We have a phoenix in the forum. Let me go next then for the sake of segue.
If you have a segue, great.
Okay, all right. I do have a segue. It's more Pliny. Pliny is the ever wealth of interesting kind of random dubious facts, depending on how you go there. Mine is Rome's relationship with elephants, which evolved dramatically across the century, from territorial adversaries facing Hannibal's beasts to awed admirers recording their intelligence and morality. And that later part there is Pliny. So they begin as a bit of a war symbol, but can either of you tell me the first mention, the earliest mention that we've got of Rome's and elephants?
Roman elephants? So you mean elephants in Rome or just the first Roman text that talks about them at all?
Well,
I don't know either, actually. I don't know why I'm asking.
It's a good question. Is it, you know, the first time they encountered elephants, they used elephants?
The first time they encountered elephants, it looks like an elephant in Rome. First time an elephant is seen in Rome is 275 BCE, so it well predates Hannibal. They called it the Lucanian ox. So King Pyrrhus, so he's invaded Italy. Was that around that time, 275 BCE?
Yes, Pyrrhus of Epirus.
So Pyrrhus has invaded Italy. They've captured an elephant from him and taken it to Rome when Hannibal led. The sight alone of the animals was more fearful to the Romans than the fight itself. That's from Polybius. But within a generation, they'd be able to counter them. So at Zama in 202 BCE, we've got Scipio Africanus training his legions to open lanes up, let the elephants go through, because I guess it's hard to turn corners when you're an elephant, and then surround them. Once they cease to be a battlefield threat, we've got them as a thing of triumph. So Pompey the Great tried to celebrate his triumph with an elephant-drawn chariot that got stuck in the gates of the Circus Maximus, too narrow to get through, which has this mental image of everything being held up and very, very annoyed Pompey and elephants.
It's also a metaphor, isn't it, for just trying to do something that's too grand.
Not to be outdone, we've got Caesar displaying 40 elephants bearing torches during games at the Circus Maximus.
That seems so dangerous.
And some elephants were trained to perform kneeling before him or writing with their trunks. And later on, you can see the thinking of elephants, I guess, is Rome becomes more acclimatized to them, as Pliny being a great admirer of the elephants. So he's opened his Land Animals book, which is book 8, the nearest approach to human understanding, and said that they understand language, remember commands, which we know from elephant studies today. They're sociable, they avoid excess, they worship the stars, and they possess a notion of religion. And he says they are said to go down to rivers and after washing themselves, raise their trunks towards the heaven and pay reverence to the stars. They understand the language of their country. They remember duties, love and gratitude. By the first century BCE, elephants were luxury imports and diplomatic gifts rather than war beasts. Apparently they come from as far as India. They come from North Africa, where the Atlas elephant is now extinct, which was an early global trade in exotic animals. Current, they've been found as far as Silchester in the UK. So little bits of ivory, but you know, ivory tools and decorations turn up in Pompeii digs and different archaeological places as far off as the distant Britain. That's my first of interest. I like how much they change in the Roman mind. Originally starting as what would have been a pure, you know, mythological terror, I suppose, if you come across them on the battlefield. To something Pliny at least acknowledges that they're beings with feelings and intelligence, which is nice to see.
Though I don't believe they could write.
Oh, well, okay.
That's a step too far for me. But who knows if you have scientific research.
I did skip over a Pliny quote. Let me go back. In the army of King Ptolemy, there was an elephant that had been trained to walk around the circle of a theatre, carrying a tablet upon which he traced Greek letters with his trunk. The letters formed words that seemed to spell out a greeting to the crowd.
Ah, okay.
There you go.
You could probably train them to do that much.
Understanding language and being able to write a letter is maybe two very different things. There.
Yes, yes.
But
yeah.
Yes. But who am I to say? Who am I to say? I'm not Pliny and I'm not that elephant.
Yes, the Pompey story is the best one. That's one, you know, always use in teaching. It's
so wonderful. Yes. The segue that I've got for this one is to go into part of an interview that I recorded for another podcast with William Dalrymple. I could not stop him talking about the relationship between India and Rome. So we will listen to that here.
No Roman source talks about the Silk Road, and no Chinese source talks about the Silk Road, for the very good reason that China and Rome had no very clear idea of each other's existence. There is not a single name that we know of anyone from China who went to Rome or anyone from Rome who went to China. And it's only towards quite late in the story of the Han Dynasty and of the Roman Empire that you begin to get references in Chinese sources to what they call Da Qin, which may well be Rome, which is this great power in the West, and in Roman sources to the land of Ceres, where silk comes from. But again, it's quite sort of, you know, here be dragons, it's vague. While scholars of the period are well aware, and it just hasn't made it into the popular literature, at the same time as there's this very vague conception of China quite late, Rome and India are each other's number one trading partners. They're only 6 weeks apart on the monsoon wind. If you're leaving the Red Sea at the right time of year, you can get to Kerala in just 6 weeks.
Yeah.
Sindh or Gujarat, much quicker. And Pliny talks about India as being the drain of all the precious metals in the world. So in rather sort of Trumpian terms, this was where all the...
Oh, this is where we're losing our good...
We're losing all our things because these metropolitan elites, Pliny's rather a sort of MAGA supporter in your terms, these metropolitan elites, by which he means the kind of society women in Rome, consist of wearing sort of semi-transparent porno wear called silk, and he regards this as sort of deeply immoral that no proper Roman woman would ever dream of touching, but also putting this woke spice on their food called pepper. He also regards as this sort of dodgy urban elite activity. And we have another writer from the same period, first century, Strabo, who talks about fleets of 250 vessels leaving the Roman Red Sea coast, sailing en masse in a great big fleet to trade with India and bring back tigers, ivory, pepper, elephants, and a whole variety of other kind of products like nard, which is the basis for a lot of the perfumery in the Roman Empire. Remember in the Gospels, that moment when Christ goes to the house of Mary and Martha and they put nard on his feet and everyone's upset because it's so expensive. That nard is a Himalayan product.
Right.
You know, it's like putting, I suppose, what would be the equivalent today, putting sort of some incredibly expensive sort of balm from Hermes or on an activist's foot, you know.
Going getting the top shelf stuff.
So that's the one half of the answer, that the Silk Road probably didn't exist in any coherent form at all during the classical period, while India was absolutely the number one trading partner. And for this reason, we find more Roman coins in India and Sri Lanka than we do in any other place outside the Roman Empire.
Yeah, you get Roman coins turning up in strange areas, and every now and then just something that is clearly from the Indian region turning up in excavations of what you would think to be exclusively Roman material. There was a Buddha statue a few years ago, wasn't there?
That's right. There's a lovely Buddha statue which turns up in Sweden, which is the very extreme example. A Buddha statue specifically from Swat in now Pakistan.
Right.
And that turns up via the Vikings, or presumably, in a burial in Sweden.
Okay, so that was friend of the podcast, William Dalrymple. I'm sure that everybody is well aware of his famous podcast, Empire. So William was a guest on La Trobe Asia's Asia Rising podcast, which I also host. So you can go there. You can listen to the entire interview, which was about India and its forgotten cultural legacy to the world. It's really good. All right. Who has something of interest next?
I want to hear Caelan's now. Is that where we're going?
I've ransacked my anthology of interest from things that are currently rattling around in my mind for various reasons. And what has been rattling around recently are the wives of the kings of Rome and what their names were and what they did. And this is because, you know, often in teaching we talk about the seven canonical, in inverted commas, you know, mythological kings of Rome, plus poor Titus Tatius, who is co-ruler briefly with Romulus. But I never talked properly about their wives. What are their names? So quiz time again, since matters, you know, introduce this. What is the name of Romulus's wife, at least in one tradition?
I do know that one. That's Hercilia.
Hercilia, yes, yes. So she is named. In one tradition, she marries Romulus. But in another, she's actually the wife of a certain Hostus and is the grandmother of the third king, Tullus Hostilius. And so we do have names of some of the wives. So Numa married Tatia, who died before he became king. And then he may or may not have married a certain Lucretia, depending on the version one follows. Now, the wives of Titus Tatius, Tullus Hostilius, and Ancus Martius are not even named. There's absolutely no record of their names. And then when we get into the age of the Tarquins, we do get named queens in inverted commas again, Tanaquil, Tarquinia, for example. And there's very convoluted dynastic issues there. And then I started thinking about, you know, why we didn't know the names of all the wives and what this tells us about early Roman kingship. And one of the things we think we know about early Roman kingship, because everything is uncertain in this period, is that it was elective in the sense that, you know, the patres, the fathers, the senators, they chose who would be the next king. And in the periods when there was no king, affairs were managed by an interrex, literally an in-between king, who had to manage affairs for 5 days. And then if the interregnum, the between king period, went on for more than 5 days, you would have to have a new interrex. So you could end up with several interreges. But the fact that this is a elective system tells us something about the role of women. A purely elective monarchy doesn't necessarily need women as part of its public image, part of its system of government, the same way hereditary rulership does. So in purely dynastic regimes, wives produce sons, daughters, sisters, and nieces marry and produce sons. And then the reproductive capabilities and marital unions of these women enable succession, such as male primogeniture, ultimogeniture, or other family forms of succession. And there were some elective monarchies which even choose successors from within the dynasty. But we don't get this in the stories about the first kings of Rome. So Romulus' son born by Hercilia, Avilius is a non-entity. Numa is elected king instead. When Numa died, his son-in-law competed for the kingship with Tullus Hostilius, but it was Hostilius who was successful. I think this is one reason why we don't necessarily have traditions or even names for these women. But I think the stories also show, particularly as we get up to the Tarquins, is this tension between this elective system of government and what you might call the dynastic impulse. That if people in a society are saying that, you know, I have regal blood, then that is going to be an idea which is going to come into competition with, you know, election on the base of virtue or merit. Now, that is just a hypothesis because we're dealing with early Rome and much is uncertain. But that's where my thinking about these nameless women led me.
I think it's interesting. I'd never really thought about this, Caelan. Interesting that we know the names of the first queen, I guess. And she's important. She gets deified in some traditions. But then we kind of know a lot more about them, I guess largely through Livy is my knowledge, when it becomes very soapy and dynastic at the end. And there are bad women. They like to talk about bad women who, you know, will kill fathers and husbands commit adultery. And so it gets much more exciting. Not really worth naming women if they're not doing bad stuff, I guess.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. Yes, yes, Tanaquil and Tarquinia and all that, the pages of Livia, are so exciting. I feel so sorry for Ancus Martius's wife because she exists to bear children and then they all die in a fire. just terrible. If they're not named, at least there was perhaps tradition that they were good. You know, that they were not bad like the last ones that Pliny delights in talking about.
Okay, well, I gather I'll be talking a lot more about kings with you next year, Caelan.
Yes.
So we'll pick up that thread.
Oh, that's exciting. I didn't know that.
Next of interest, who wants to go next?
Well, I have a link to bad, or at least demonized, women.
Oh, okay.
Perfect. It's a bit of a depressing one. I was going to do it third, but I think I'll get it out of the way now because I don't want to end on a nasty one, because I'm going to talk about name calling in ancient Rome, and it's not just name calling of women, but name calling based on gender. There's a bit of toxic masculinity going on here. Or is it just funny?
Oh, God. Wow. Okay.
I mean, there's plenty of this that goes on, but I thought I'd center particularly on names that involve, stick with me here, the Palatine Hill. Now, the Palatine Hill, you probably know, is the kind of posh center of Rome. Just insert your own local context for this. For us in Melbourne, it's Toorak, I think. It's the home of the emperor. And it's also used adjectively in a few Roman insults we know about. Now, we do know the Romans were very good at political insults, attacking their opponents in nasty language. And this often targeted their gender or sexuality. Things like when Cicero accuses Antony of putting on the manly toga and turning it into the sex worker's garb, the toga mulieribus, the womanly toga. Cicero is indeed a master of this form of nastiness. In his speech defending Caelius, perhaps the Pro Caelio, one of his most famous speeches against a charge of attempted murder and other things, he calls Caelius's accuser, Clodia, all kinds of names, accuses her of all kinds of depravity, including the Medea of the Palatine, the Medea Palatina. Now, there is a bit of comedy in this incongruity. The Greek myth or Greek tragedy context of Medea, alongside the sophisticated urban setting of the Palatine Hill, as I've already mentioned, the poshest bit of Rome. Medea, if you know your mythology, is, she's a witch, usually, semi-goddess, I guess. She is a multiple murderer, though. Part of the tradition is that she kills her brother and tears him into little bits and throws him into the sea in order to help Jason, of Jason and the Argonauts fame, escape from her dad. And then when Jason betrays her and leaves her for a princess, she murders their two children. So this is not a good thing to be called. This is kind of highborn Medea, highborn murderess is what he's suggesting here. Bad woman all round. And indeed, without saying it outright, Cicero does strongly suggest that Clodia had poisoned her very highborn husband. Oh, wasn't it just convenient that he dropped dead at that point? And, you know, there might have been some poison around the house kind of implications. Quintilian also says that Caelius himself had labelled Clodia a quadrantaria Clytemnestra. Now, this doesn't involve the Palatine, but it means, again, Greek mythology, Clytemnestra, a murderess, killed her husband. And this means a Clytemnestra who sells herself for a tiny worthless coin. So again, the mythological murderer and the seedy Roman context this time, I guess in direct opposition to the Palatine in some ways. Let's get back to the Palatine, though, for one more example. And indeed, I can't resist going back to the elder Pliny, because he tells us that Marcus Brutus, not that one, had an argument with Lucius Crassus.
Not that one.
Not the famous Crassus, but the Crassus who was consul in 95 BCE, and dubbed him Palatine Venus. This is my favorite insult of all time, I think. These are both very Roman terms. We don't have any Greek myth here. But part of the joke is that there isn't a shrine to Venus on the Palatine. In Pliny's time, there is a Palatine Apollo, famously Augustus's temple, and plenty of other temples to Venus in Rome, of course, because she is Rome's goddess. The accusation here is about sexuality, effeminacy.
I was about to say it sounds like it's a bit of a,
exactly.
1980s kind of Tim Brooke Taylor kind of hand motion going on.
I think you'd go back to the 70s.
Oh, 70s for Tim, yeah, 70s for Tim.
And there's an implication of luxury here because what he is being criticised for is having built a temporary theatre. Now, this is not a bad thing to do as a Roman politician. And he had installed 6 columns of Hymettian, that is Greek from Attica area, marble. So Hymettian marble, which is sort of bluey white. But then he moved them to his own home. So this is Pliny in his marble book towards the end. His point, however, is that Hymettian marble isn't even that extravagant anymore. So he's using this as in early times, they thought this was extravagant. And they were only 12 feet long. Back then, this was a scandal, and it should be a scandal, but now we're so inured to it. In fact, even by 58 BCE, so still a long time, over 100 years before Pliny, or around 100 years before Pliny, Scaurus was putting up 360 columns of posh Lucullan marble in his theatre, and then moving the tallest ones, 38 feet long, not just 12, to his own home. So this is how depraved we've become. Palatine Venus wouldn't even cover it anymore, is what Pliny's thinking. But it's great that he reports this insult because, nasty as it is, in terms of insulting someone's sexuality, I think it's having a bit of a go at that, or certainly their gender presentation. It is kind of funny.
It's kind of funny. it's interesting how what's outrageous not all that much earlier is now just mundane. That happens now in modern day politics. If some of the stuff that goes on now happened in the 1970s, it just would have been a scandal bigger than Watergate kind of thing. Insults in politics is second nature as well.
Yeah, so. I don't think they're as funny as they used to be, though.
No, that's quite
although
a good one.
Some would claim that... No, I won't say it.
I do love the idea that, you know, the Romans' temporary theatres, in inverted commas, are like these huge, ornate constructions anyway. You know, often we think of temporary, we think of, you know, little wooden shacks or something like that. But, you know, these are huge, ornate buildings. It's just really, really fantastic.
And apparently a way of smuggling posh columns into your own home afterwards.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. It's a tax write-off. Yeah. Okay, do you have a segue, Kaelin?
I have a segue on names. So we talk about names, so different form of names. So this isn't sort of witty names or name calling, but it's what emperors or their dynasties called themselves, which is another particular thing that I've been... nutting out recently. So the Julio-Claudians, we all know them as the Julio-Claudians. The Romans as well referred to them as the Julio-Claudians. So particularly Tacitus's histories, it's written in the early 2nd century CE, but, you know, he frequently joined the two gentes, the two families together. You know, he uses terms such as the domus, the house, Juliorum Claudiorum que, so of the Julians and the Claudians. Sometimes use the term familia as well, the household of the Julian and the Claudians. But I've also been thinking about, you know, what Romans called themselves. And of course, you know, there was the Gens Julia, the Gens Claudia, you know, the Julian family, the Claudian family. But in the official rhetoric of the state, they never actually called themselves that. This isn't just nitpicking. I do think that there is a larger point here. The customary term, as Rhiannon will full know, I'm not saying anything new here to experts, is the Domus Augusta. This makes its first appearance in literature in Ovid, in his poetry. So the Domus Augusta, the Augustan house, particularly in his letters from Pontus, where he's been exiled. You know, he talks about, you know, Augustus, Livia, Tiberius, Drusus, Livilla, Agrippina, and other members as, you know, the Domus Augusta, so the Augustan house. This first appears in what we might call official state rhetoric in senatorial decrees of the early Tiberian period, particularly the senatorial decree concerning Gnaeus Piso the Elder. He's the guy who, when governor of Syria, accused of, you know, arranging for Germanicus to be poisoned, which is what everyone remembers, but he's also charged with much more seriously for the Roman view of, you know, fomenting civil war, the crime of maestas or treason. In this document, the imperial family, imperial house, the Julio-Claudians, are referred to as the Domus Augusta consistently. Why was this the case? Why didn't they call themselves, at least on extant evidence, the Julio-Claudians? It's probably because when you're drawing together two families, you know, you want to impose, you know, a sense of unity around them with one term. And also, you know, if you have this capacious term like Domus Augusta, you can also use that to define, you know, precisely who is and who is not a member. And I think that serves, you know, a very useful purpose. I'm interested in exploring this with all the other, you know, dynastic names as well, you know, Flavians, you know, Antonines, Valentinians, Theodosians, etc. Because I don't think it is just hair splitting. I think, you know, what people call themselves and what other people call them, I think is an important way of conceptualizing how people see the world.
Yeah, so we'll be waiting for your report back on what the later dynasties do then. Because the Antonines in particular is just, it's fraught. Do you attach it to that one member of it? Or is it the adoptive? Or we never know what to call them, do we?
That's exactly right. You know, is it the adoptive, the five good emperors, the Antonines, plus Nerva and Trajan? Is Hadrian Antonine? My early reading shows that the Romans themselves had similar problems, particularly that long, expansive family. And of course, the Severans, we call them the Severans, but, you know, they viewed themselves as, you know, still part of the Antonines.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
What you're talking about with the Domus Augusta is fascinating as well. And I wonder, and I'm not asking this as a quiz question, Galen, but whether it's related to who gets into the mausoleum of Augustus and who doesn't, who gets excluded for bad behavior or whatever.
I think I would completely agree. And this is really interesting because, you know, the mausoleum, you know, as you know, is planned really, really early. And I love this idea that, you know, Augustus, you know, has this idea for, you know, his family, his domus, even before he gets the name Augustus. And that just always blows my mind. Do you have a segue, Matt?
My next one's, you know, name-ish. An inscription discovered near Concordia was said to commemorate the first female centurion. I emailed you about this, Rhiannon, saying, this one's Latin-based. Do you want this one? Prepare for me to butcher Latin in this one. Have you heard of this one, Caelan?
No, go ahead.
So this was in 1975. So no Roman source otherwise mentions women serving as officers of the army. But this inscription, the way that the text is arranged on the stone, was what we now believe to be the centurion's name first. So Valerius Valerianus. And underneath his wife, Valeria Maxima, and next to her and the way that they were stacked above each other was the word centurioni, so to the centurion. And it could appear to refer to either. So I call this dodgy inscription / dodgy interpretation in 1975. So it actually reads, to Lucius Valerius Valerianus, centurion of the 1st Italic Legion, and to Valeria Maxima, his wife. That's what it's believed to be now. But as commonly happens when people see this and quickly go, oh, female centurion, is that this just caught on like wildfire back in 1975. Plus it got included in a museum display attributed as a female centurion, which really didn't help matters.
You want to name and shame the museum?
I don't have it here. I've got a local museum in Concordia. So it doesn't say which museum in particular. It was later corrected, but I saw this recently on TikTok, female centurion. You know those dodgy accounts that are just going for men who think about Rome every day kind of accounts.
Yeah.
And it came up with this, you know, female centurion and an AI image of, you know, a dashing, big-bosomed, charging into battle.
What does it say about your algorithm that this is what's feeding you, Matt?
Well, the thing about doing a Roman history podcast is that people send this stuff to me. I'm not on TikTok.
Officers were always allowed to be married, and then under Septimius Severus, the marriages were acknowledged. So if it's third century, that would be that would fit into that context.
I think it's notable that the inscription was found and then interpreted in this way in the mid-70s, because it's sort of the height of second wave feminism, and there's probably a bit of wishful thinking going on there.
Yeah, I can't imagine the Roman army being that liberal though to send a woman into battle.
No, but you could do a TV series on it.
Oh, definitely. Sure. Definitely. Give it time. The closest they got to battle was Mark Antony's wife's name being scrawled on missiles and thrown across the wall. Yeah. Caelan, did you want to do your last one?
Yeah, so I also have false identity, I suppose. That could be a nice segue. So I know you've done the false Neros recently. So everyone knows about the false Neros, and they do now after listening to the podcast or going to Rhiannon's lecture. I have a false Theodosius in the 7th century. And this is because I just love false, you know, imposters and everything like that. They're so amazing. And this is a really interesting story. It's quite tragic. The Emperor Maurus in Byzantium and Constantinople in 602 was deposed by the usurper, the centurion Phocas. So that's another excellent segue. Now, Maurus had 6 sons. 5 of them were murdered by Phocas and his forces. The youngest was a mere baby. But the eldest son, Theodosius, escaped the massacre because he'd been sent on a mission to the Persian Empire. However, he was soon recalled to Constantinople, where he was captured and killed by one of Phocas's officers, a known as Alexander. However, the contemporary historian Theophylact Simocarta tells us that the news of Theodosius' death was not believed by the inhabitants of Constantinople. And this is because when his father and brothers had been executed, their heads were displayed publicly at the Hebdomen, which is the parade ground, like the Campus Martius of Constantinople. But Theodosius' head was not put up there. So a rumor began to circulate that the man who had been executed had been a lookalike, and that Theodosius had escaped to foreign lands. Now, Theophylact Simocarta, who tells this story, says he investigated the rumor and found it groundless, but he said it was widely believed by others. One of them who believed this was the new emperor Phocas himself, and when he heard the story, he had his own officer Alexander for being duped by a doppelganger. Now, a few years later, continuing rumors of Theodosius' survival were plausible enough to prompt his mother and his sisters to plot against Phocas, but they were discovered and executed. Now, there was no happy ending for Theodosius, even in the world of rumor that he had survived, because it said that he eventually committed suicide. Now, interestingly, there is a parallel tradition that survives in Syrian, Armenian, and Islamic sources that Theodosius did survive the coup and managed to reach the court of the Persian Shahanshah Khosrow II. The Persian Shahanshah then crowned Theodosius as Roman emperor before invading Roman territory. One senior Roman general, Narses, who had remained loyal to the deceased Maurus and his family, subsequently recognized Theodosius as the true emperor when they met in Edessa. So Theodosius, just like some of the false Neros, tangled up in Eastern politics, in this case Persia, not Parthia. And in these traditions, Theodosius is last attested in about 607-608 CE, when he persuaded the population of a city in Armenia, known as Theodosiopolis, to surrender to Persian forces. Now, this is a really interesting story. Some modern historians do take it very seriously and suggest that Theodosius was not an imposter and that he was a genuine article. He really did escape being killed by Phocas's forces. And you know, this is why genuine authority was invested in him by the Persian Shahanshah Khosrow II, as well as Narses the general. However, you know, his flight to the Persians in search of legitimacy and support certainly does recall the efforts of the second and third false Neros, but also many other imposters throughout world history who have used foreign powers to try and achieve their aims, or alternatively were manipulated by those foreign powers themselves. So whether or not Theodosius really survived, I think it's unlikely. The belief that he did survive and escape played a significant role in both internal and external politics in the 7th century CE.
It's really irresistible, isn't it, this idea that there might be survival when it's not clear, absolutely clear, that there's a death. And here it seems like the political utility of this character is a bit clearer even than with the false Neros, that, you know, he can persuade a surrender to happen.
Yeah, that's massive.
Yeah, so because the false Neros, there's lots of singing and dancing all through Turkey and everything like that. Mm. And it doesn't really affect Rome itself, whereas this is, you know, real turbulence within the city of Constantinople. You know, is he alive? Is he not? Where's his head? We need to see the head. So it does suggest, yeah, as Rhiannon said, some real political impact.
When I was making my notes for that episode with Zach, came up with about, you know, a good half dozen modern parallels to people who had survived toppled dynasties. It never came up in the episode, but yeah, it's
well, the Romanovs are the most famous modern one, I guess.
The Romanovs, yeah. We're top of that list, but there are other examples. But yeah, it's something that the power of belief, the desire for something to still survive. Yeah.
I have an entire chapter in my forthcoming book on rumours about people coming back from emperors or their relatives coming back from the dead or surviving execution.
That's
a plug.
very good segue. Okay. Rhiannon, did you want to go next or do you want to go last?
I don't mind. I'll go next. All right, so I'm going back to names, but this time dodgy etymologies. I mean, so many of these in ancient Greek and Roman texts. But I'm looking particularly at ethnic origins in North Africa, in Sallust. Now, this is sort of getting towards the edges of Roman geographical knowledge. And Sallust is, of course, two remaining complete works. And one of them is the war with Jugurtha, who's the ruler of Numidia, at war with Rome at the end of the 2nd century BCE. Sallust writing around 40 BCE. And in a move that people have decried in both Caesar and Sallust, about halfway through or so, he decides, it's time to tell you something about Numidia. And so a lot of older ancient historians have never understood why this happens. But it's what he does. And he says, where do these people come from? Well, he reports a tradition that randomly combines the native Africans with people the Romans know more about from the east. He claims that he has an authority for this, which is not always the case in ancient histories. He says that it comes from the Punic books, I'm quoting here, said to have been written by Hiempsal, who's a Numidian king. He says the first inhabitants are, he doesn't call them this, but I'm interpreting it as your typical primitive peoples, the way he describes them, very, very normal in ancient ethnographies, the Gaetulians and the Libyans, and they were crude and uncivilized. They're even compared to beasts. They eat the flesh of wild animals and the fruits of the earth. So in other words, they're not practicing agriculture. They're not practicing even pastoralism. They just kind of get their food where they can. They are nomads without laws, so pre-civilized. Sallust, or Hiempsal maybe, wants to weave the Persians and other Easterners in here. So he goes mythical. Hercules died in Spain, apparently. You might read other traditions elsewhere. And the remnants of his army sailed over to Africa. So that's how they got there. The Persians then joined up with the Gaetulians, where the land was bad. All right, so they had to move around a lot. So they were called nomads, hence the Numidians. This is my first dodgy etymology. This is both rubbish etymology and based on no historical migrations. No known historical migrations, I should say. Sallust's proof, if you want it, I put that very much in scare quotes, is that the Persians used the inverted hulls of their ships as huts because there was no timber in this land. It's an interesting fact, at least interesting to Sallust, that even now the houses of the rustic Numidians, as he calls them, which they call Mappalia, are oblong and have roofs with curved sides, like the hulls of ships. So their houses look a bit like ships. Therefore, these are people who've come from elsewhere. And the elsewhere is where I've already told you it is. Although this isn't really proof because I don't think it's like the ships of people we know come from those places. But anyway, let's not question it. Where do we get the other name from? Well, the Medes and the Armenians, our other Easterners, join up with the Libyans. And they take their names from the Medes, which eventually becomes Maori. M-A-U-R-I. Now, the only similarity I can see here is the letter M. To explain this, he says they call them Maori in their barbarian language. So even Sallust knows that this is not very close sounding, that the etymology doesn't really work. Anyway, they all end up as Numidians because the Libyans were more into namby-pamby trade, well known in both Caesar and other ethnographies that if you trade too much, then you're not tough. So they were less warlike, and they fell under the power of their tougher neighbours. And all the vanquished were merged in the race and name of their rulers. I think this is a great lesson in ethnohistory, and I believe every word of it.
Megalia, they're used in Virgil's Aeneid, aren't they? In the book about Dido, book 4.
Mapalia.
Megalia.
Oh, it's M-A-P, sorry. I probably pronounced it properly.
Oh, M-A-P, right, okay. Yes, okay.
A-L-I-A.
Oh, okay, because Virgil is Megalia. But it's for huts as well. So I did wonder if it's the same word.
Well, it might be. I mean, it's closer than some of Sallust's etymologies, yeah, so quite possibly. And who knows, this might have been written down wrongly by Sallust or later writers or anything like that. So
it sounds
quite
like
possibly.
It's completely written down wrongly by Sallust. It sounds like he's making it up as he goes along.
I think he's reporting what he believes to be true. And he is, I mean, you don't always get them claiming a source. So this is quite striking that he says he has a local source, basically.
All right, very good. I've got interesting name stuff to finish us off.
All the names.
Yes. So this is in 2021 when a tomb was excavated from outside Portisano Gate at Pompeii. This was the tomb of Marcus Venerius Secundio. And the inscription read, Marcus Venerius Secundio, freedman of the city, guardian of the Temple of Venus, Augustalis, and adjunct to these, on his own he put on Greek and Latin spectacles over 4 days. So the reason that I'm including this as my of interest is because, well, the inscription tells us a number of things. Firstly, he's a former slave and that he was owned by the city of Pompeii, which I didn't realise was a thing. I thought, you know, people had to own slaves. And I guess as a public slave, he's some kind of, well, a literal public servant, I guess, in the best of terms, and he's serving in the Temple of Venus and the Augustalis, so that's where they venerate the previous emperors or the current emperors. And his name reflects this. So his second name, Venerius, comes from the full name of Pompeii, which is Colonia Cornelia Veneria Pompeianorum, which is Pompeii's official full title. The archaeological team who did the excavations from the University of Valencia theorised that he was from Greece because it was quite a thing to be, a former slave and earn enough money to put on 4 days of Greek and Latin spectacles. The other interesting thing about him was that he was actually buried. He wasn't cremated. So when they found him, he'd been mummified using asbestos. Ooh. So there was asbestos over the top of him and underneath him as well. So excavate with care, I guess.
When did they find him? I hope they knew by that point.
2021. It's just a couple of years ago.
They need to be
So there was some of his white hair was still there and his left ear was clearly visible. You can Google images of this. And he had 2 cremation urns with him, one belonging to a woman named Novia Amibilis. So, yeah, I thought that was interesting. But one more inscription, which is outside the Starbian Gates in Pompeii. This is another grave inscription, a lot more pedestrian in, you know, it's from a cremation. And it's quite a long inscription, and it was clearly an important person. And it's fragmentary, so we don't know for certain who this was, but there's theories because there were only so many people in Pompeii who were this rich. On receiving his male toga, this is what the inscription says. This man held a celebratory dinner for the people of Pompeii, consisting of, here's an exact number, 456 tricliniums with 15 men at each triclinium.
Packing them in there.
Yeah, well, there's a couple of things here. So from this number, 456 times 15 gives you 6,840, so close to 7,000. So if that's an accurate account, that's just male citizens. So if you add to this women, children, non-citizen, slaves, and people who have a second residence in the area, it gives you an estimation of about 45,000 people who live in Pompeii, but that's like the greater Pompeii region. And that's now given the current number of about 20,000 living within Pompeii itself. That's what the current estimation of the population of Pompeii is based on, this one inscription, which I thought was really quite interesting. Now, there are estimated, and they've done this with GIS surveying, that there are 1,400 dwellings in Pompeii of one form or another. So if that figure is correct, then you're averaging of 14 people per dwelling. So you are really packing people into Pompeii. So there you go. That's my of interest.
It's a lot resting on that inscription.
I know. But I know. But there's a lot of heavy lifting going around when you're doing things like that. Mm. You know, they've had the number of 20,000 for Pompeii for quite a while, even before this inscription came up. So they're quite happy with that kind of number. And they are actually quite certain on the amount of dwellings that they're predicting as being around Pompeii, keeping in mind that you haven't got a lot of second levels and things like that. But it's a fairly interesting.
So quite crowded houses, if that's true.
Yeah. Mm. Well, the other like slight segue of interest, and this is a complete coincidence that this happened, is that last year they brought in visitor limits to Pompeii, and it's 20,000 visitors a day they put the cap at.
Mm.
That's true, 15,000 in the morning. It made my trip to Pompeii very stressful because I needed to get there early enough. And then there was a strike, Galen.
Oh, no.
There was a train strike on the Circum Vesuviana.
It's just interesting when you think when you're walking around Pompeii now with potentially up to 19,999 other people, then that's how crowded Pompeii.
Well, but it's not all excavated.
I know. But you know, look in the forum, that's probably the same amount of crowds.
This is why they need to excavate the rest of it, so we've got exactly the right number.
Exactly the right number of people we can calculate.
All right, okay. Thank you both for coming.
No, thank you so much.
Io Saturnalia, if I don't see you before then.
Yes, indeed. Thank you. Yes.
That was Associate Professor Rhiannon Evans from Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University and Professor Kaelin Davenport, Head of the Centre for Classical Studies at the Australian National University. Also, a special shout out to friend of the podcast, author and podcaster himself, William Dalrymple. I'm sure you know, his podcast is called Empire. And that's it today for Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, please subscribe in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your local friendly neighbourhood podcatching service. Please leave a review, they are always very appreciated. You can like Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow us all on Blue Sky. This podcast has been recorded at the Bundoora campus of La Trobe University in Melbourne, Australia, on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people. So until the next episode, I'm Matt Smith, you've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.